Welcome to the Fundraising Talent Podcast. I'm Kyla Daw, and I'm glad you decided to join us on today's episode of the show that is shaping how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent. Rather than advice from experts, our listeners want to hear the insights and ideas from those who, just like them, are on the front lines every day, building meaningful relationships that translate into meaningful support for causes that they and their donors care about. Every week, we invite our guests to have a real conversation about what it means to be a fundraising professional. We're after a greater understanding of what it means to be one of the sector's critically important yet least understood roles, while giving honest answers to our profession's most difficult questions. Thank you for joining us in this episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. Here's your host, author, fundraiser, and master trainer, Jason Lewis.
Hi, podcast listeners. This is Jason Lewis, and I am your host for the Fundraising Talent Podcast. I want to thank you for joining us today for the show that is shaping the way that the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent. Before I introduce today's guest, I want to thank One Cause for being our sponsor. This episode is brought to you by One Cause, the creator of user-friendly fundraising software that helps nonprofits engage donors, raise more money, and save valuable time and resources. Offering a full suite of cloud-based online and event fundraising solutions, OneCause has powered 5,000 organizations, well over 20,000 fundraising events, and helped nonprofits raise more than $2 billion. To learn more, take a complimentary, no-strings-attached online tour of OneCause by visiting www.onecause.com/responsive60. That's www.onecause.com/responsive60. Hi, Claire. Thank you for being on today's episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. You and I have had some wonderful introductory conversations here before we hit the record button, and I'm really looking forward to this conversation. Before we get started, would you mind just introducing yourself to our listeners?
Yeah, hi, Jason. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me. My name is Claire Gates, and I have recently founded a consultancy group called 8Masts, which works with charities and not-for-profits as well as commercial businesses.
Yeah, so before we hit the record button, we were talking about going in a completely different direction. We were going to have you share some thoughts on a particular series that's upcoming. But then you made a comment. You said, I am unimpressed with fundraising in the United Kingdom. And I think, as I shared with you, I have been somewhat unimpressed with fundraising on a global scale as well. So what does that mean?
Yeah.
Unpack that for us, and let's go down that path. Let's have fun with that.
Yeah, absolutely. So I started my career in Big Four accountants, so KPMG and PricewaterhouseCoopers. I worked with them for 8 years and doing consultancy and working with corporate businesses. And then I moved into the legal sector, and it was whilst I was there, I was working for a law firm that specialised in the charity sector. So I got to know the charity sector quite well from a legal point of view and the charities that we worked with. And one of their particular clients was a charity called Help for Heroes, which exploded here in 2007 at the height of the war in Afghan. I think you have a similar Wounded Warrior charity there.
Yeah.
And coming from a military family, I felt compelled actually to go and work with this organization. I was delighted to have the opportunity to do it. And they were going through a massive change program. They needed to turn themselves from an appeal charity effectively to a long-term fundraising charity. So I worked with them to do that. And I suppose walking into a brand new sector for me, I did what anybody would do and signed myself up for a couple of fundraising seminars whilst also sort of writing my own strategic plans. And I just remember distinctly going to my first national conference and sitting in a room full of fundraisers and actually being dismayed by every single speaker. The terminology they used, the way that they talked about donors, the use of behavioral science and other different manipulations to garner donations. And I just thought, wow, is this what it is? Is it such a soulless machine? And actually, do you have to work that hard to extract donations from people? You know, what's wrong with your proposition? What's wrong with your cause that you have to work so hard? So, I must admit, I turned on my heels. I didn't make some of this quite known at the time to some of the speakers, but I turned on my heels and walked back to my desk and said, right, I'm going to do this a different way. And so that, for me, was the start of it. It was going really, really back to basics. And I did have the luxury of working with a blank sheet of paper and having no previous person to work after or any preconceived ideas. But all of the learnings and everything else that we know from any other, if you like, customer-centric industry,
yeah,
just doesn't operate that way. And you do it at your peril, really. So customer is king, and when you do that, everything else just falls into place.
So you've used a couple of terms that I'm incorporating into my new book. So I'm very intrigued by your use of language, or some of the language you've used. This idea, one of the things I'm diving into is this idea that we have allowed sort of the machine metaphor to sort of inform everything that we do, and then consequently it informs our behavior. I have to imagine that's probably, you're describing yourself sitting in that conference room and you're hearing language that sounds like a machine that's designed to exploit value.
We're talking about but at the base of it, exploit people as well, yeah, ultimately.
Yeah.
That's what disappointed me, because it was absolutely that.
Yeah. And so where does that, so what I'm figuring out as I'm researching this, you know, where does that machine metaphor sort of come from in our culture? It comes from the Industrial Revolution. The first phase of it started over there in Europe, and obviously it came to the U.S. We started, you know, building railroads and big, large machines, and eventually automobiles. In your opinion, is fundraising just that sort of that last professional field of work that is sort of inherited that sort of value system?
I think in part. One of the comments sort of I made to you before we started recording, uh-huh, was, for me, the sort of the massive gap between fundraising and the charity it works for. For me, it seems like the fundraising sector, if you like, has become a subsector of charity and almost operates separately and operates slightly rogue, in my opinion. You know, I think if you went back to, you mentioned Olive Cook and her tragic death back in, was it, yeah, the end of 2015, early, sure, 2016, which shone a light on some of the charity practices here, specifically around direct mail and the massive volumes and the repeated asks. And it just highlights for me, and irrespective of whatever you thought of all of that, it just highlighted to me that the senior leadership team, nay, the board of any charities involved in that, must have been so blinded or unaware of those practices taking place, because you'd like to think that it would have never occurred had they have known. Because I just can't imagine a board member of a charity which has its reputation at stake that would allow, you know, a member or a department of its team to go off and undertake those practices. And that's, for me, where I saw a disconnect almost, where fundraising is simply about get the money almost at any cost. And it seems like their only motivation, the next director of fundraising who comes in, it's just more than the last guy, please, more than the last guy. And then you hand that money over and then the charity decides how to spend it. But this is where I think the danger lies.
So part of what I wrestle with, and if you were in a seminar session with me, I mean, I did a session in Detroit just last week on this, some of this same stuff that we're talking about. I tend to think that the people that were in that room with you that day, where you started hearing language that you didn't appreciate, that their professional identities have gotten wrapped up in something that over years, if not decades, it's hard to, once you sort of get into a pattern of habit, it's hard to break. Mm-hmm. And that's why in the book that I wrote, I characterize a lot of this behavior as a form of addiction. You know, it's like they can't. And so part of what concerns me, and I interact with people here in the U.S. and occasionally with people over in the United Kingdom, where fundraising has become, because it's just as much of what you're describing there in the U.K. is, I would say, 10 times over here in the U.S. But pushing back on it, you're messing with who they are as people. And that's what seems so difficult. Are you following my thinking there?
Yeah, I completely agree. Yeah, absolutely. And this is where, so in my mind, certainly writing, so for the charity I was with, our fundraising ethos, our ethics, what we would and would not do.
Yeah.
You know, what we wanted from people. Money wasn't even on the list. And this is where it comes back to, you know, we are a charitably minded nation. You know, we give £10 billion a year to charity here.
Yeah.
And although the number of people giving to charity is declining every single year, the value is therefore going up from those people giving. So our value still goes up.
Yeah.
But less people are giving. And this comes back to that trust issue. So, you know, it's been highlighted here that less than 50% of people trust charities or find charities trustworthy. And in a really remarkably low number of about 21% actually find charities trustworthy. I mean, that's exceptional. You know, the whole charity sector is meant to be a lovely, fluffy, warm environment where, of course, everybody thinks it's there for the great and good. But if only a quarter of people actually truly believe that you're trustworthy, I mean, what does that do? And you have to only look to fundraising practices for that result. Nobody will have looked at the output of a charity, because charities output incredible things day to day. They make a huge difference. And so I can't imagine that distrust has been garnered from charity services and delivery. That can only have come from fundraising practices. And whenever you see a charity dragged through the coals in the press here, it is around fundraising and salaries potentially, but fundraising and salaries tend to be it. And so for me, again, it comes back to this almost rogue business of fundraising. But having been let to go that far, the reputational risk to their particular charity, but also the sector alone, has been devastating with these practices.
But I get into these conversations. So I'm part of part of a particular think tank group there, and they're a part of a thread of conversations that routinely happens on Facebook. And a lot of people in the United Kingdom are part of those discussions. And as it relates to the press, we don't have the press problem here in the United States, like I think you guys has been playing out for the last, say, 5 years. But instead of sort of being introspective and sort of asking ourselves, okay, how do our practices needs to change? There's just a typical what you would expect of a, you know, like my 16-year-old kid putting up his fist and sort of a defensiveness, you know. If you're behaving badly, they're going to find it and they're going to talk about it. And the only way you're going to get them to not talk about it is to start behaving, you know, more appropriately.
And I think that's the important thing. I think, you know, the fundraising sector here is very insular. You know, they have their own press and their own magazines, and they talk yes, to one right. another and almost and they defend their behaviors to one another.
Yes. Right.
And again, you're absolutely right that the external press is there to hold a mirror up to charities and to fundraising to say, OK, but when you compare it to how the rest of the world operates, that's just not how things are done. And for me, one of the great tragedies is the lack of people coming from different industries and different sectors into charity and into fundraising to bring that different perspective. As I say, for me, I walked in and was blown away because I was expecting, you know, if you like, Dorothy going into Oz, everybody happy and skippy and everything else. But I didn't. I walked in and thought, Christ, what a mess. This is awful behavior. I wouldn't want this. I wouldn't want to be associated with some of these practices. That just doesn't sit right with me. But one of the barriers to that then is several fold. Again, the salaries here in the fundraising sector aren't brilliant. Are they going to attract people into them from outside where they could be earning more? No. It's catch 22 though, because without bringing some of the really bright young next generations in to create some of the innovation that will make the sector more sexy and interesting for people to choose it instead of anything else isn't there. The investment from charities into those sorts of jobs, again, to attract either young graduates or people from another sector across to come and do DigiSpace or AI or anything else that really the sector should be keeping up with compared to everybody else, it's just not there. And at the same time, you know, I've talked about, you know, when you bring in corporate experience into the charity sector and people sort of suck through their teeth at you and they go, oh, no. We don't want to be corporate. Ooh, no, that would be like the worst thing that could possibly happen to a charity is to become corporate. And it's a strange, strange thing because actually you think, well, okay, if I replace the word corporate with professional, do you have a problem with that? I can't think that you could or would. And I think that's what it is. There's this strange misconception that corporate and professional is the antithesis of charity. And it's almost like we're all just doing our best, rocking along day to day. And we do it in the name of a good cause. So, you know, we can't be held up or held accountable sometimes for a lot of our actions because it's being done in a good name. And I think charities fail to realise that actually they are complex organisations with a lot at stake. The fact that they exist for charitable purposes is by the by. Their stakeholders are the beneficiaries, you know, and they exist to provide those services. And actually, in some respects, it's more important that they're there and behaving as efficiently as humanly possible than a shop down the road.
So, Claire, I was recently having a conversation. I've actually had a conversation, two conversations, one with a woman here on the East Coast and then with another woman, coincidentally, on the West Coast in about a 30-day time period. And they both said to me, very anecdotally, there's no definite research behind this, but they both sort of both said to me that they're of the opinion that the number one problem that we struggle with in fundraising right now today is that we just simply don't know how to have meaningful conversations with our donors. And so we're crafting every sort of way that we possibly can to basically avoid what Henry Nouwen, in his little small book, The Spirituality of Fundraising, calls it a call to conversation. And so the question is do fundraising professionals, in whatever they do they just simply not know how to, or is too large a majority of us just do not know how to sit down across the table from an individual and have a conversation like the one you and I are having?
I think it's 100% right. I think when you look at fundraising teams, let's take a standard charity and you look at your income split, you know, you've got your individual giving group, which is over here especially predominantly direct mail, which obviously you don't talk to a donor at all. You work with an agency, you work with a fulfillment house, off it goes, you press a button, and pretty much you don't even have to really get involved if you don't want to. It's almost like fundraising outsourced. You can almost guarantee what your return rate is going to be on those, and that just runs. You then have your events team, your major giving and your corporate partners, but they're much smaller teams. And so we have, actually, when you take the number of staff, say, in your fundraising team, such a small proportion of them are equipped and trained and able, like you say, to have those meaningful conversations. Part of it is, frighteningly, they don't know enough about the organisation they work for and probably couldn't have a meaningful conversation or perhaps an up-to-date conversation about what it is that charity does.
Yeah.
And it's sad that I have seen, you know, say that gap isn't just metaphorical between fundraising and delivery. It's sometimes it's even geographical. And then never the twain shall meet, which is that I was very fortunate that wasn't the case for me, and I instilled that in everybody. But even more so then, the donor also stays at arm's length to the cause.
Yeah.
Because they don't get that sense of feel, that sense of touch.
Yeah.
And it's not appropriate for every charity, of course, to bring donors into what you're doing.
Sure.
But the beauty today is with everything online, with the access to videos, you can take snippets to your phone, you can do vlogs, you can do all of these things. The ability to bring causes to donors now and have those conversations and kick them off and create networks and create conversations is more apparent than ever before. And this is where I say that for here, certainly in the UK, the major shift of everything being direct mail, offline post, you know, one-way DRTV ads or ads, there hasn't been that innovative shift to keep up with other sectors and other industries that I would have expected. And for me, I would suggest that's because the leadership has had no experience outside of any other sector to almost bring that courage in.
Yeah.
For somebody to come in and say, right, do you know what? I know we've been doing this for 150 years this way, but now we're going to give it a try this way because actually we've done our research, we've done our thinking, we've done our testing, and we're pretty confident that actually what's the worst that can happen? And we just don't seem to have that bravery. That if fundraising dips for 1 year, it's a black mark, it's a blot, instead of taking that longer view. And that, for me, comes back to, you know, the charity's mission.
I mean,
what's it there for?
Do we even, so the fundraising professionals that you know, I mean, I have met a number, since my book came out 2 years ago, I have met, and having given some commentary on your sort of current reality over there, I've made some friends over there, and I think I've made some enemies as well. But do you, Of the fundraisers that you know, how many do you know that actually gravitate, that they're sort of compelled, that their movement in the way that they work, their patterns, actually suggest to you that they want to eventually at some point get to the lunch table and have a cup of coffee, or in your case, a cup of tea?
Do you know, I think the thing for me is fundraisers are now almost employed into their little subset.
Uh-huh.
So almost, so if you go into individual giving these days,
yeah.
don't expect to ever speak to a donor. It's almost that way. And so all you do is you maybe hire a load of introverts into that job, and off they go and they do that bit. Obviously your major donors, absolutely. Although even then, and I don't know if it's the characters then it attracts, or if it's the lack of training or lack of maybe confidence or autonomy given to those fundraisers to go off and have those conversations. But still, there still weren't as many conversations, and certainly face-to-face conversations, telephone conversations, any other type of conversation that were really happening. And this is where I was very keen to look to, with supporter engagement or donor care, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah.
Again, that group of individuals sat completely separate again. There was fundraising over here. You then had donor care as a little sliver in the middle and deliveries that far off to the right. And for me, a fundraiser and donor care, they're one in the same. You know, we talk about the importance of a thank you. Well, if you have to take the money in one hand and then hand it over to somebody else who then has to eventually go back and thank a person, then that very human link is lost. So little is done in real time these days, which for me, as I say, is ironic when we live in such an immediate world where anything is possible immediately. That things take such a long time. And again, for me, it comes back to infrastructure, lack of ingenuity and innovation, lack of resources within a charity. You know, they still do operate on quite an archaic system, a lot of them, or a system at all, if you're lucky. And that is a layover from years and years of investing the money in your beneficiary, which I totally understand. And again, that comes back to the scrutiny I think that charities feel under here, especially that they need to prove that money is being spent in the right way and the highest proportion is going to beneficiary, of course.
Is it Is it class? Is it just simply a division of class, and that fundraisers are basically behaving like a bunch of technicians that don't know how to relate to somebody that isn't in their same sort of class system or whatever, you know, whatever that basically we can't relate to people that sort of live in a world that we don't live in?
But you know, there is definitely an element of that. And it is a sad stereotype, but if you do look across, if you took all of the individual giving and regular giving fundraisers in the country here, and then took the major gifts and high net worth donor teams, you would see a very different type of fundraiser who speaks a different way, has a different name, has a different background, because they will be trying to find some sort of a simile. But at the same time, hey, if I'm going to walk in and speak to a multimillionaire, trust me, I have nothing in common to do with him that's his money. But this is, again, what's sadly not taught. What's in common is this cause.
Yes.
Because that guy isn't going to take your call if he doesn't already share a passion for what you're doing.
Exactly.
And again, for me, this comes back to instilling that confidence and autonomy and belief. And again, it comes right back to my initial sort of comments about fundraising. It's gone cold. It's about money. It's not about the discussion. It's not about that relationship. It's not about putting an individual in touch with something they feel passionately about.
I don't know if it's, you're saying it's going cold. Is that what you're saying?
I
don't think it's gone cold. I think we have professional. I have never articulated it this way, so you get credit for helping me. And I say some bold stuff.
Okay.
I think we have professionalized. I think what you're describing, we have professionalized an inferiority complex, is essentially what we've done. Right?
Yeah, I mean, quite possibly,
I mean, isn't that essentially what we've done? We've basically figured out how to sort of exist at an arm's length from these people that share a common interest, a common whatever. And we don't, and so we've essentially made it perfectly legitimate to use the word exploit, to exploit value. But what I don't think the fundraisers themselves realize, which is usually the message I'm trying to convey to the fundraisers, the people on the receiving side, is that these organizations are essentially exploiting value out of them as well, because they expect them to carry all this stuff out. I don't think that the fundraisers themselves understand that they're getting caught up in a system that eventually might like collapse.
Exactly. Yeah. And there's certainly not enough professional development for fundraisers when they're in role. I think if you enter the sector as a fundraiser, depending on which organization you're lucky enough to work for, there's very little in terms of professional development, either that sort of structure that a party can follow and gain accreditation in. But there's very little training that happens as well.
But Claire, does that even matter? For you to say that there's so very little talent out there, which we hear a lot, but it also sort of begs the question, do you even want the talent that you could get? Because the talent you're going to get, I mean, I tell my clients, I've got a client here nearby in Philadelphia, we're going to identify somebody. I have convinced this particular client, we're going to find somebody who doesn't know anything about fundraising. We're going to find some basic underlying fundamental values and skills that they have, and we're going to sort of raise them up from the ground up.
But that's also my point, though. People come in and they're just let to get on with their own devices. They never improve. They never get better, is my point.
Yeah, right.
There's very, very little. Very few times have I seen and it depends obviously on the size of organization, granted, but the director of fundraising intimately involved in fundraising. And for me, it always begs the question. I was listening to some of your previous podcasts, and Lisa Harwood was on a while ago, and she was talking about the silos, and it's frightening. And again, it comes back to every other industry has figured out that silo working is counterproductive and is harmful to your business and everything else. And when I've gone along to different fundraising events, whether it's for legacies or tribute fundraising or regular giving or anything else, the teams are like, oh, no, we don't talk to them. Oh, no, we don't have anything to do with them. I don't even know where the team is. And I just think, then what's the director of fundraising doing? What's their job if it's not to build this cohesion and have this flow? I'm left aghast at what their job actually is. This is kind of what I want to get to the nub of. What is a director of fundraising's job today in the current world of charity? And what should they look like? And what should they bring? And what should they be doing? And what should their focus be? Because as I say, generally, it's please make more money than the last person.
So we have had our listeners now for plus 20, 25 minutes. Before I let you go, if anybody's intrigued by the conversation that we're having today and they want to reach out to you and say, how dare you say such things?
by all means. I always love a healthy debate.
Yeah. How would you suggest that they reach out to you?
Well, they can find me on LinkedIn as Claire Gates at 8Masts, or they can email me at claire.gates@8masts. That's eighmasts.co.uk.
It's been a pleasure. I look forward to it. You're always welcome to come back. And I certainly
thank you. Yes. And there's a spare room here, Jason, if you ever want to come over and have that.
I'd love it. Thank
have
you.
That set.
Have you read the book that nonprofit leaders and fundraising professionals alike are calling a must read? In this pocket manifesto for today's fundraising professional, Jason deconstructs why many of us find ourselves working for organizations where we cannot accomplish our goals. These same organizations are notorious for rapid turnover and high donor attrition. To avoid this all too familiar path, Jason offers direction from those who want to be recognized and admired for their work. The war for fundraising talent challenges our ingrained beliefs and assumptions about how effective fundraising really works, and it questions the prevailing wisdom hiring decisions and donor behavior. Published by Gatekeepers Press, The War for Fundraising Talent is now available on Amazon and other major retailers. We want to thank you for listening to today's episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. We hope you enjoyed today's show and hope you will come back for next week's interview, where we will discuss with those on the front line who are defining what it means to be a fundraising professional. If you'd like to be a guest on the Fundraising Talent Podcast, visit our Facebook page or email Jason at jason@lewisfundraising.com. In your email, be sure to tell us about where you work and why you believe you would be a great addition to the upcoming lineup. Thank you again for joining us today, and we look forward to you being a part of the continuing conversation as we shape how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent.